The following talk, Pathways to College, was presented by Elliot Grosso at the Oregon Christian Home Education Association Network's 2022 conference, Joy in the Journey. Dr. Grosso is the Vice President and a tutor at Gutenberg College.
Thanks very much. It's a great pleasure to be here, and thanks so much to Ocean Network for inviting me to be here and speak to you about college and how we might think about it. So this can be interactive. You can have questions or comments as they come up. Feel free to raise your hand. We're going to talk for the next hour about kind of two components about college. One is kind of philosophically sort of how to think about it. How are we going to think about this thing called education? How do people typically think about it? Are there other ways to think about it? And the other half will be sort of logistical questions. So before, if you are thinking about doing college yourself or with a child or student or something like that, these are some of the questions that I would ask and get answers to before I enroll at a college or start paying for a college or things like this. So let's take a look at this together. So I've got six essential questions that I want us to look at. The first is, what is education? Number two, what is higher education? Number three, how does education work? Number four, the myth of college. Should we believe it? Number five, what should I expect from an average college and what should I do about it? And six, is excellent education possible? And if so, how might I obtain it? So I'm a homeschooling dad. I have three kids. They're 11, 9, and going to be 7 tomorrow. I've been teaching in higher education in North America and Europe for the past 15, 16 years. I've worked with admissions departments. I've worked with recruiting, fundraising, scholarship committees, all these sorts of things. So I've seen a lot of the back end of the industry and want to share some experiences with you that I've observed. But I'm mainly a teacher. I want to help students think about what matters and to think clearly about what matters and think about it from a biblical framework. So let's take a look at this first question together. So what is education? So the next question, of course, is, who is education for? And so just so we're on the same page, I'm going to give you some definitions that I'm working with in terms of how I might think about these things. So I'm going to define a human being as a finite and limited sinner created in the image of God, and who, while rebellious at heart, holds out hope for redemption and salvation at the gracious and loving hand of God. And so, depending on what you think a human being is and how they work and how they learn, that's going to impact how you're going to go about educating them. One of the things that I found as a homeschooling parent is one of the things that I appreciate about the freedom to homeschool my kids is I get to have a say in sort of the environment that they're in and who they interact with and how they interact with them, hopefully for their betterment, though I have my shortcomings, as you'll soon find out. So what is education then? Education is the holistic transformation of the human being, as defined, for the better, through a sustained inquiry into what is good and what is true. So education is some part of a human being's growth process. It's a transformational process in which there's repetition, there are new ideas that get repeated, and we are so changed in the process of practicing those things that we come into contact with in this thing called education. Education doesn't just happen in a classroom, it happens constantly in all sorts of venues and environments. But that is how I would think about education. So what is higher education? It's a particular kind of education. So higher education is education during a time of life in which young adults begin to take on full responsibility for their ongoing growth. So essentially the difference between higher education and prior years of education would be that in higher education, the child has potentially moved away from home, and for the purpose of moving them in the direction of taking ownership of what is it that I'm going to do with myself, what am I going to believe, why am I going to believe it, on what grounds am I going to say something is true or worthy or something like that. And it seems to me that this process, at whatever age it takes place, is kind of essential. We have all made pretty important decisions that we live by, all of us in this room, and the way in which one goes about that is fairly important. So higher education is a phase of life, usually traditionally between ages 18 and 25, but of course it can be slightly earlier or later. There's no parameters there, but That's how I would think about higher education. So what role should higher education play in one's life? So I would argue that higher education should help a human being live a life that is pleasing to God. That is the primary function, as I would see it, as a Christian with a biblical worldview, which is not different from most other sorts of things, is that living a life that is pleasing to God is something of importance, very high importance to the Christian. Okay. So we've looked at what education is, what higher education is. Let's take a second to look at how education works. I find this particularly interesting. So I spent a lot of time as a child learning to play Irish traditional music, and that was very different in structure from how I learned, say, to do arithmetic or grammar or things like this. When you're learning to play Irish music, you go and basically do an apprentice-style learning where you're sitting with other musicians. They're much older than you. You're playing music together, and you're watching and learning and imitating and things of that sort. So it's much less an Irish musician sort of like giving you a lecture about how to play Irish music, but it's totally immersive, and you're learning all of this tacit knowledge by observation. So it's quite different. And I was trying to think, you know, as a teacher myself, you know, how exactly does the educational process work? I mean, everyone learns a little bit differently and sometimes a lot differently, but can we boil this down into a framework that we can use to think about, well, why would you go to college and what might you do there, for example? And so I came up with this analogy. Maybe it's a metaphor. Maybe it's a metaphorical analogy. I'm not sure. But there are four parts. There are four parts. There's this thing called the game. There's a trainer. There's equipment. And there's an athlete. So how do all these pieces work together? So let's talk about the game for a second. So the purpose of a game, I would argue, is not necessarily to win, but rather to play well. Games have rules, and rules create boundaries around what constitutes good play. So some things are encouraged while other things are not encouraged. This is this thing called the game. So when it comes to the athlete, anyone play any sports in here or maybe even musical instruments? So games are complex. Anyone play a game? Go fish. You know, you don't always want to go fish, but you still like to play anyway. Because games are complex, an athlete can never truly control whether he wins or not. It's basically impossible to make sure. So what the athlete can control, however, is whether the athlete respects the rules of good play. This is called sportsmanship. Playing well is not merely a question of observing all the rules, though the rules are important. Playing well also takes skill. It takes endurance and precision and the ability to predict where people will go on a field and things like that. So the athlete must be interested in playing well before the athlete will be willing to practice these things. Such skills must be cultivated through practice. And so what is practice? Well, practice is repeating something until it changes you. Anyone ever take piano lessons? Did you enjoy your practice time at the piano? No, it's kind of tedious, right? I mean, you know, take this finger and press this button 800 times until mom or dad or someone says, yeah, you're done, that sounds great, please stop pressing that button, I can't take it anymore. But after you press that button enough times, suddenly your body remembers how to play it. Like when my girls are practicing the piano, we practice 2 days in a row, and I say, well, okay, yesterday was Thursday, today's Friday. Was the piano harder to play today on Friday or yesterday, Thursday? And naturally the answer is, well, today it's easier. The more I practice, the more I change in accordance with what I'm trying to do well. So that's what the athlete is trying to do, and repetition is essential to practice. And so to be educated is to practice. It is to practice certain patterns of thought. It is to practice certain skills until you are changed by whatever it is, the thing that you have practiced. Musicians aren't good because they have 10 fingers. Musicians are good because what they do with these 10 fingers happens many hundreds of thousands of times until it's easy. So you are changed by what it is that you practice. So, how about the trainer? Well, to practice well, it seems to me that an athlete needs a trainer. The right trainer is the one who cares both about the rules of good play and who knows how to help the athlete practice well. So you have to have an ideal in mind. You have to understand what it is that we're trying to do, and we have to know how to practice to make that good thing happen, Can't just be one or the other. They have to both happen at the same time. So a good trainer will know these things, not by mere philosophical abstraction. No one will teach golf by the idea of golf, but one will teach golf having played lots and lots and lots and lots of games, and won a couple and probably lost a whole lot more. So this is essential. This kind of real-life experience is very important in handing off the how to practice to the student who also wishes to do so well. And then finally, we have the equipment. So the trainer must have the athlete practice on suitable equipment. The equipment should be designed by someone who understands the human body and how to challenge it incrementally. Okay, so if equipment is too easy or too difficult or faulty, then the athlete's practice is going to suffer. So if you think about, say, lifting weights. I mean, if you're trying to get to the heavyweight championship, I'm making things up because, as you can probably see, I know very little about actual exercise. But were someone trying to do that, you would need to know how much you can weight and where that, you know, razor-thin boundary is between where you are and where you want to get to. And someone skilled has to know, sort of like, here's what we should do. You don't want to be lifting dumbbells with weights falling off and that sort of thing. So, student, let's see. For the athlete to grow in skill, the following conditions are ideal. Both are interested in playing the game well, according to the rules. The athlete must trust the trainer, even when training is difficult. Right? So we've all tried to do things that are hard. Might have been our parents, might have been our teachers, and they're like, I know this is hard, I know this is brutal, it's killing you, but you gotta keep trying, trust me. Go a little bit further, you gotta push yourself a little bit further. Anyone experience this as a homeschool parent or student, where sort of like, I don't know if I can get that extra inch going, but if we could, that's what we want to do. The trainer must care about the athlete's growth, and the equipment must be suitable for practice. So there has to be this harmony of elements. This seems to me that these are essential components to learning. So if we were to break it down, okay, the game would be life, right? We're trying to live well. We're trying to live a life that is pleasing to God in the way that I defined it earlier. And so this involves a trainer, the teacher. Teacher could be anyone who is doing the teaching. And the athlete would be the student, the one who is trying to do the living well. And what intersects them is the equipment. So the trainer says, you, student, use this equipment. You read this book. You pick up this shovel. You set foot on this ball field, whatever it is. And then you start to practice. You start to repeat and repeat. And so you have to have care and trust kind of going both ways. You have to have the desire to play well here, from the athlete. If the student doesn't want to live a life that is pleasing to God, there's very little that you can do to coerce them into wanting to live a life that is pleasing to God, or at least that's been my experience. The trainer has to have some experience doing this. The trainer has to understand and recommend the stuff that the student is interacting with, because a lot of learning is interacting with new stuff. And then it has to be also suitable for practice. So let's look at an example for a second. You know, if these things kind of didn't all work out harmoniously, right? So let's say if you had a really avid student and a really great teacher, but they were trying to play different games. I mean, you wouldn't have an astrophysicist try to teach a student microbiology. It just wouldn't work. Wouldn't matter if you had two geniuses, but they're not playing the same game. They're not trying to do the same thing. What if you had different rules? You know, we're playing the same game, but we don't agree about the rules. You have an astrophysicist who keeps insisting that the Earth is flat, for example, when the student assumes that it is round. Well, we don't have the same assumptions about the thing that we're working with, so we don't agree about the rules. How are we going to get anywhere? It's going to be really hard. What if you have bad equipment? You have an astrophysicist who is recommending tabloid newspapers about extraterrestrial life. And this is how we're going to do your advanced degree in astrophysics, is to ask questions about this. You would say, yeah, that's interesting stuff, but I don't know if that's all current all the time. Or you just might have selfish teachers. You might have teachers who are taking advantage of students for their own personal ends. They're trying to make their careers, or they're trying to do whatever. So you have to have a blend of these sorts of things, it seems to me. Okay. So, in my view, that's a lot of how I see education working. Any questions at this stage? Comments? Okay. Not yet. Well, we'll see. So, let's look at the myth of college. Should we believe it? So, the myth of college goes something like this. You probably are all familiar with it. The game is this: to go to the best school so you can get a good job and live happily ever after. That is the myth of college, as I encounter it in a nutshell. And so I'd like to address these three components of the myth in reverse order to see sort of, you know, how are these put together? What are the assumptions there? Are they good assumptions? Are they not good assumptions? And I would pose first this question: live happily ever after. Is the point of life to live happily ever after? Is the point of life my personal happiness? Is that the main goal here? I'm not going to answer that question for anyone in this room, but I think it is a worthy question to ask. On happiness, the 20th century Russian historian Alexander Solzhenitsyn said that if man were born only to be happy, he would not be born to die. Since his body is doomed to death, his task on earth evidently must be more spiritual, to leave life a better human being than he started it. So we could ask, is the point of life my personal happiness? Let's look at the next one. Get a good job. So we could ask, well, what makes a job good? We live in an industrialized economy. We have to work. We have to earn money. These are all essential components. I would acknowledge that these are important things. But what is it that makes a job good exactly? Is it the paycheck? Is it the social status that I get from doing my particular job? Is it the vacation time that I get? Is it my opportunity to advance within the ranks of the company culture or that sort of thing? Or is it about things like mission and purpose, fittingness, meaning and significance? What am I being asked to practice in my job? And I think this is one of the really complex things for us as Americans, is that industrialization and technology sort of tend to fragment our existences, where we live highly modular lives, where, for example, I don't know if you've ever seen a unkind Facebook post or social media post or something like that, but lots of times, you know, people would never say that sort of thing to your face. And so that's just one example of the evidence I see of us being encouraged by various sorts of technologies to live modular existences. So for example, I'm willing to be one kind of moral person when there's no accountability, but then when we're face to face, suddenly I become a different kind of moral being where, you know, you're going to let me know if I say something unpleasant. And I think that's just the tip of the iceberg. I think that's the tip of the iceberg when it comes to our kind of moral fragmentation as it comes together. And so this whole what am I asked to practice piece, you know, if we're talking about going to college and college is a four-year experience, maybe it's a one-year experience. Of course, there are lots of different ways and routes and degrees and timelines. I'm not saying there's one right way to do that. But whatever it is that I'm being assigned to complete is the thing I'll be practicing. And we're going to get to the logistics of this in a second. So this human being who I have voluntarily submitted myself to be taught by, what are they going to have me practicing is the question. And how are they going to have me practice it? Because all that stuff's going to make a huge difference. It's going to make a huge, huge difference. So we want to ask that as well when it comes to work. Okay, so what is the meaning of my work? And there might be lots of meanings to one's work. Not saying that there is one particular meaning, but if I'm going to be doing it 40 hours a week, whatever it is that I'm doing in my work is the thing that I'm practicing most. I'm practicing with my best energy, my best hours, my best time. I'm going to become what I practice. So what sorts of things do I want to be focused on? What sorts of things do I want to be practicing, and how do I want to be practicing them? This seems like an important question. So, I'm bringing this up, of course, because this is the second component of the myth of college. And so you may say to me, Elliot, what about statistics? Aren't there lots of statistics about colleges and jobs and outcomes and these sorts of things? And let's read a couple of statistics. Why not? What the heck? So America has 331 million people, roughly. 135 million of them have graduated from college. The average student debt is $30,000. 41% of college grads work in jobs that don't require any college degrees. 28% of grads don't work in their field because there aren't enough jobs in those fields. The average American holds an average of 12 jobs in a lifetime. So imagine you pick a major for something and you change 12 times over the course of your life. You may be very far from that very expensive major, or you might be very close to it. It would depend on who you are. The average student changes majors 3 times. And the following companies are not interested in college degrees at all: Google, Nordstrom, Bank of America, Ernst & Young, IBM, and Apple. 27% of adults with at least a bachelor's degree say they don't have the education and training they need to get ahead at work. On average, the college grad earns $1,500 more per month than the non-grad. 16% of all Americans think that a 4-year degree prepares students very well for a well-paying job in today's economy. Roughly a third of adults, 35% to be precise, say it should be to help individuals grow personally and intellectually. That's college. While 50%, by contrast, say college should teach job-related skills. Further, employment increased 77%, from 49 million to 86 million, in jobs requiring higher levels of analytical skills. 35% of the job openings will require at least a bachelor's degree. 30% of the job openings will require some college or an associate's degree. And 36% of the job openings will not require education beyond high school. So let me ask you this question, with all of those very, I'm sure, expensive numbers to procure. Whose life has worked out exactly as they thought it would? Anybody? Nobody? Okay. So then my question about statistics is, are statistics promises or observations? Is God checking in with the statisticians to making sure that he's got your plan all tightened up, make sure that he's got you in the right spot? Or are these doing something else? So I think it's easy to sort of be flung a lot of data and to assume that such data are determinative, that life will definitely go a certain way if I do X. But I can only say in my short 11 years as a parent that a lot of things have not gone as I had predicted or would have liked, and certainly less than ideal sometimes, despite my having tried very hard, or at least believing to have tried very hard. So, point number 2 about the myth of college. Go to the best school you can. Okay, so what makes a school good exactly? Well, is it famous faculty? Is it luxurious facilities? Is it extracurricular activities? Is it name brand recognition? Is it social capital via networking? Are these the things that make a school good? Might there be other things? Education is the process of holistic transformation for the better, and is achieved through a sustained inquiry into what is good and what is true. So, I don't know about you, but I can imagine that there might be at times a disconnect between these two projects. And it all boils down, I think, to what do I think the purpose of life is? What am I doing with myself, and why am I doing it that way? How am I thinking about this stuff? What does it mean to be human is going to precede how it is that I spend my time and what I spend my time doing. Again, that's how it seems to me. So we could ask things like, well, what's of greatest interest, a degree or an education? And I would say that, I haven't said this, but I will say it, that I don't pretend to know what God has in store for any particular human being, as it were. So some students will have college in their futures. Some students will not have college in their futures. Some students will take a traditional route. Some students will not take a traditional route. So please don't hear me say that there is the one right way that I am explaining right now. These are just questions. These are just questions that I would want to have clear answers to before I started investing in a college situation personally, because college seems to be very, very expensive. It has outpaced inflation significantly over the last 15 years, and that is not because education has become more valuable. It is because colleges vie with each other for the brand recognition of degrees. And so the question is, what is going into the educational environment that I'm going to be participating in, and consequently, how will I be invited to practice? All these things connect. The economics connect with the classroom very, very readily. And we'll talk a little bit about how that works. But before we do, one final question. Does the myth of college surrender control to God, or does it encourage us to pretend that we are in control? So this is one of those kind of tricky things that theologians argue about, is how much control does man have in various domains? And I would need more than an hour to explore those various positions, and so I will not explore them. But it seems to me that, on the one hand, I have a decision to make. I can attempt to apply to go to a college. Whether I get in will be a different question. I may be accepted to colleges, and then I may have to choose which colleges it is that I do or do not attend. So somewhere in here, God is doing a thing. And somewhere in there, I am doing some choosing of things. So, like I said, I don't pretend to know how it works. I don't know how it works. But the question is, when it comes to the myth of college, I think that as a myth served up not by the Bible but by other things, what sort of practicing am I doing when I interact with those three components? Am I practicing to have total control, that if I only do X, Y, and Z, then I'll have L, M, N, O, P? Is that what I'm promising myself? Am I taking it for granted that there will be definite probable outcomes based on statistics? Or am I actually not in that much control over those sorts of things short-term and long-term? Again, I will let you decide what it is that you think. Okay, so that is kind of the philosophical framework half of how we might think about college, higher education, how it works, what it's for. Want to open the floor. Are there questions or comments, reactions to any of the things that you have heard me say? Not yet. So let's talk about some of the nuts and bolts of how colleges work on the interior. So what we're coming up to are things that you can do. Okay, if you're thinking, I want to go to a college, I want my child to go to a college, these are things that you can do. I prepared a handout. It is not here because the content of the handout is different from what I'm presenting here, and I didn't want people to get confused looking down and looking up and letting me know that I was not following the outline, because I'm not. But there's a handout at the Gutenberg College table. I think it's slot number 309, and they will gladly give you one of these outlines to take with you if you are so interested in such an outline. But it spells out a lot of this stuff, and it gives you the list of things that you can do, the two do's when it comes to researching colleges. So let's look at a couple things here. So what do faculty do when it comes to colleges? How are faculty incentivized? What's the difference between a research and a teaching institution? How are institutions structured, and why does it matter? And what role do economics play in a curriculum? So for the homeschoolers in the room, you are the faculty in your homeschool. You pick the curriculum, you pick how it is explained, you pick how to incentivize students or discipline them. You make a lot of these decisions. Professors in universities do the very same thing. They create the learning environment. They are the trainer, as it were, to your athlete. And the question is, well, how is it that they are going about that? How does this work? How do they think about what it is that they're doing? And so part of the question is, how are faculty incentivized? So, I mean, they're paid, but there is this thing called tenure. You guys heard of tenure? Tenure is basically a lifetime job appointment that you get from doing certain things. And so parents, when educating children, I have found, at least for myself, tend to find themselves in quite a sacrificial role. There are lots of things that I would probably not even do for myself that I attempt to do for my kids so that they will get the greatest possible benefit. The benefit to me would be hopefully some sleep at night, maybe. But hopefully I'm preparing them to live a life in which they know how to think and make decisions some way, somehow. That's what my goal is. So the question is, well, how are instructors incentivized? Well, a lot of times it's with this thing called tenure, because a lifetime job appointment is a pretty sweet offer, especially if it's in the high to five to early six-figure range. So the question is, you know, when you have this trainer-athlete relationship where the instructor is creating the learning environment for them, and it comes down to doing what's good for the student or what's good for one's career, what kind of decisions are people going to make? I once had an instructor say to me as a graduate teaching fellow that you don't get tenure by meeting with students. So that seemed a little bit odd to me. This person was not available to interact with students because they were busy working on other sorts of things that were going to do other things for them career-wise long-term. And certainly not everyone is like this. But this would be the sort of thing to figure out before one commits to an institution. Talk to instructors. What are you like? What is it like? And I'm going to tell you who to call and how to call them, and they're not going to like that I'm telling you how to do that because it's going to take up a lot of time. But if you're going to pay them a lot of money, they should give you the time, in my opinion. So this is an issue. There are also research and teaching institutions. So in fairness, there are research institutions where high-grade faculty are paid to create new knowledge about the world around us. So, for example, the recently deceased Stephen Hawking was a scientist in England working primarily at a research institution. Might give a talk here or there, but generally working on research, doing scientific research, and not accessible to undergraduates. So to think about an institution that has kind of a bright, sparkly name, like a Stephen Hawking, one might ask, well, how available is this person going to be to an undergraduate who has important questions? That's a question. That's a question that I would ask. Because if this is the method of incentivizing for research institutions, how are the instructors going to think about how they spend their time? Are they there to serve the students or doing other things? Now, by contrast, there are teaching institutions where instructors get tenure by doing a good job teaching. And so as you're thinking about different institutions, you know, you might think, well, I really want to find a spot where teachers are committed to teaching. That's really what I want for my student, my child, myself. And so we want to find a teaching institution where that's the focus. So the way when we get tenure there is they might publish a thing or two, but really what they're working with are student reviews. So students saying, yes, I had an amazing experience with this instructor, and they had lots of time for me to talk, and it was splendid, and I got a lot out of it, and I grew personally, et cetera, et cetera. So there are different kind of institutions. For example, someplace like the University of Oregon is primarily a research institution, and smaller private liberal arts colleges tend to be more oriented toward teaching. So again, I don't know what God has for your family, but this is a distinction to ask about. What kind of place is this based on what you're interested in? And so to get tenure at just about any institution, there are three components. There's research in varying degrees, there's teaching in varying degrees, and there's also service in varying degrees. What service is in a college is sitting on various committees where decisions have to be made. So like faculty senate, where we're trying to decide about the parking lot policy, or we're going to spend 5 hours here allotting, you know, $100,000 worth of scholarship money. Who's it going to go to? That kind of stuff. So research, teaching, and service. That's how someone gets tenure. So how are institutions structured? So essentially, and this is what's over at the Gutenberg table if you would like a copy. I do not have this blown up, but essentially, and I'm going to give you some tools here. You know, the president, who's in charge of the entire functional institution, there's a board above the president, but you have the board, you have the president hires the provost, okay? The provost is in charge of all the academic programs universally in a college or university. So the provost hires deans. Okay, so you got a president, you got a provost, and in some place, a very large research institution, you might have multiple schools with the dean each. So you might have, say for example, the College of Arts and Sciences has a dean. College of Humanities and Letters is its own school. It has a dean. These are all part of one university. And then the dean hires all the faculty, ultimately. So when professor of whatever retires from the music department, it's really the dean's job to make sure that that position is filled if institutions intend to fill it. So the thing that I would do if I were thinking about college is, number one, I would email the dean or call the dean of the school that is of interest to your child and ask them a bunch of questions to see how it is that they go about their hiring. They might be Christian, they might be not, but still you want to know sort of who's constructing this educational environment that I'm paying six figures for maybe. And here are some questions. Does your institution offer its faculty tenure? Why or why not? Does tenure hinge more on research or teaching? What personal qualities do you look for in faculty before you hire them or give them tenure? And this is kind of an important one. Do you employ adjuncts? You guys know what adjuncts are? An adjunct teacher is someone who is hired just to teach a particular class. So your tenure track faculty have a lifetime job experience, and they do these three kinds of things. They get to do research, teaching, and service. Your adjunct just does teaching. And so what's interesting is that you might have a school that has a lot of bright, shiny faculty members, but all the teaching is done by adjuncts. Okay, so as the parent, you don't get to decide whether your child is in the class of the bright, shiny person, because it may be more economically efficient to put an adjunct in that classroom instead of someone who's very, very expensive. So on the one hand, marketing from colleges will tell you that we have 1,800 geniuses here, but when you get there on day one, you may be instructed by someone who is an adjunct instead of someone who you've been marketed to. And so this is an important question to ask. This is how economics actually impacts the experience, because when it came to the I'd say the crash of 2008 or the economic issues we were having there, you know, people, high-paid, long-term tenure-track faculty would retire, but everyone's finances were in a state that the school wasn't going to hire and fill that position. So, like, say if a music department had five faculty members and one retired in an economic crash, well, now they only have four full-time people, and then they hire adjuncts ad hoc to teach whatever courses need to be taught. And so the interesting thing is that adjuncts are human beings too, and they have to make a living, and they might teach at multiple institutions to do that sort of thing, but as such, they are interacting with the culture of the institution differently from someone who has a lifetime job appointment. I mean, imagine yourself, sort of like, well, if you're going to hire me for life, I'm going to interact with this thing differently from if I have to hop to four different colleges in a week to make a living. So how available is the student and the teacher to interact with each other should that be needed? That's going to boil down to the adjunct question. So do you employ adjuncts? How are they selected? What percentage of classes are taught by adjuncts and why? Do students have advisors? What makes a faculty member a good candidate to be an advisor? Anyone have college advisors in your days? Advisor experiences can be really great and profitable and growth-oriented, and they can also be other things as well. So what role does an advisor play in the life of a student while the student is enrolled? So again, this is sort of a different sort of thing from even, say, you know, let's say you homeschooled for a while and decided to send your child to do 11th or 12th grade at a school. This is an on-site, total, holistic, immersive experience. And so what we want to do, or what I want to help you do, is to think about, it's like, well, you know, wherever it is that God has you to go, how might we think about finding a mentor, someone who could be a mature, supportive, thoughtful listener and interlocutor when, as the person is growing up and making huge decisions about how they're going to live, who is going to be there to listen to them and to interact with them? Now, hopefully, I mean, my hope is that my kids will still listen to me and I will listen to them. But it's just at this point of leaving home where, and having taught for a long time, I've seen this as like, you know, hey, Dr. Grasso, like, what do you think about X? And I will attempt to give a coherent, well-formulated response to whatever it is that I think about X. Or I've had students come up, you know, right before exams, and they'll say, oh, Dr. Grasso, I'm so, you know, I just broke up with my fiance or something. And, you know, it's like, oh, that's kind of earth-shattering. You know, we should have a conversation about that. Depending on who I am and what I'm like, that conversation could go a lot of different ways. And so, if it were me, I want to find someone who my kid can interact with and talk to. And sometimes that person can be a faculty member, which is actually really great. So let's say you've asked all these questions and, you know, you've talked to the dean and you've interacted with them and gotten some questions answered, some critical questions. Then you say, okay, well, you know, I really feel like, you know, what we need to be doing is microbiology. It's like, okay, well, let's look at the biology faculty and see what they're like. You know, are these the kind of people we can have a intelligent conversation with or not? I mean, essentially, that's the question. And so then start emailing the faculty. Just go down the list in the biology department and say, so, what? Here's some questions that I would ask. Number one, why do you teach? Number two, what is your philosophy of teaching? How do you go about it? How do you go about this training that we're going to, that you're creating the environment for? How do you go about that? What drew you to your subject of interest? Now, what turned you on about biology? What do you want for your students? What are you hoping that they will become in the process of interacting with you? How do you believe that interacting with you achieves these ends? And lastly, are you available to meet with students outside of class time and outside of office hours? Why or why not? So these are questions for faculty. I would also recommend totally stalking faculty on social media and seeing what they're really like. Do they post gritty, nasty, critical things? Or can they be talked to? Can they be reasoned with? I wouldn't go to the school website for that because you're just going to see a big trophy case. Which tells you a little bit, but maybe not all the things that you would need to know. So these are things that I would ask about them. Look for, well, what's this instructor's worldview like? And that's not even an argument for saying it has to be the same as yours. Just know what you're walking into. Like, what are they like? What are their assumptions? Can you figure it out? I've learned a lot from people who I disagree with. But the question is sort of, what sort of assumptions and situation is the student being put in, knowingly or unknowingly? What are the instructor's religious and political beliefs? And how do they handle disagreement when there is disagreement? And fourth, what kinds of articles, images do they post? So, you know, you might look through a biology department and ask all those questions and get a bunch of answers and do all your research and all that kind of stuff and decide, yeah, this, you know, this seems like the right spot for my student. But it doesn't seem like anyone I talk to is going to be a good mentor for them. They might not be the right, you know, support person on site, boots on the ground sort of person. That's okay. There are campus ministries, there are local churches, there are community organizations. You know, start reaching out. This college might be very nearby, it might be very, very far away. But chances are, with enough research and inquiry, you can run into someone who is sort of like, yeah, I'd be willing to have a conversation and build a relationship with them. So it's not, one doesn't have to choose between sort of insulating someone forever or shooting them out of a cannon. There's actually a lot of research in between that one can do to sort of, you know, to the best of one's ability. No one can predict the future, but see kind of what it is that is available. What options are there? That sort of thing. Of course, much of this hinges on the attitude of the athlete. What is it that the student is ultimately interested in, and why are they interested in it, and how do they want to live, and all that kind of stuff. But when it comes to, you know, worldviews of instructors, one student said, this, I found that having college instructors who share my basic worldview is helpful in encouraging me towards truth during this great life transition. But further, I think it is important having instructors who acknowledge where a student is in their process, wherever that may be, and are comfortable with dialogue. I feel like it is a combination of these two things that truly helps grow a student. So, if you can find a professor who is going to fit that bill, that might be a good mentor for your student. Another student said this. Let's see. Worldviews change what a person values in an education, in writing, in discussion. If your basic worldview doesn't match with your professor, you end up with a massive gulf, and the people offering you the education often won't present you with the things you believe are valuable and want to pursue. There's that kind of practice question. Opposing ideas, however, are very important. They cause growth and can help create both confidence when you find out you are right and humility when you learn you are wrong. A teacher should differ enough to challenge you and bring you different angles on ideas. But when a person disagrees with you fundamentally, it makes it more difficult to communicate with them. And that is not a problem you want between you and your instructor. So again, if we're willing to try on the definitions I put out at the beginning, who's education for, what is it, how does it work, hopefully this will help navigate sort of some of these questions. I don't think one needs to proceed with terror or reticence if they have a good toolbox to interact with. At least that's my hope. Okay. Questions about this? Go ahead, Pam.
I have a comment. It's a veteran. I've got three kids in college, and I didn't do any of this. And so I didn't think about any of this. And I'm just bored because I should have been. And so this has been very eye-opening. That this in particular, like asking these questions and thinking about that in terms of why we're doing what we're doing.
Sure. No, I appreciate making the point that this is sort of new information and wishing you had done it. I mean, if I hadn't spent the time I had spent doing what I've been doing, I wouldn't ask these questions either. Having seen the advantages and disadvantages of various systems and approaches, it's sort of like, oh man, this is really working for this student right here. And oh man, this is really not working for this student over here. So it's been at a tremendous cost for me to even be able to ask these questions. So I hope they're helpful questions for all y'all out here. And please feel free to share liberally the handouts if you pick them up. I would love for parents to be able to ask these questions on their own, even if they're not in the room. Thanks for your comment. Other thoughts or questions or things like that? Okay. Well, in that case, I have one more slide, and that is excellent education possible? And if so, how might I obtain it? So again, a lot of this depends on what God is doing in your life and your family's lives and your students' lives, but it seems to me that based on my experience, I've noticed some trends that are tremendously powerful and helpful for students, even if it doesn't necessarily always guarantee them the job that statistics guarantees them that they ought to be guaranteed. So, number one, truth. Students and faculty are more interested in what is true than in ideological agendas. Secondly, goodness. Students and faculty allow an external standard of goodness to govern learning and conclusions. So a faculty member is just as likely to learn something from a student as vice versa. Faculty have enough humility to be able to learn something, to be corrected, to be wrong, if in fact they are wrong. And of course students too. Method. Faculty engage students in honest dialogue to help them draw conclusions. So the faculty member is not there to grandstand as such, but they're there to interact. They're there at the service of the student to help the student think independently and learn the skill of pulling all the pieces together into a coherent and meaningful whole on their own, the picture that they can own themselves. Great books, or we could say great literature, or we could say great ideas, exceptional fuel because of big questions, excellent writing, and significant insights. So there's, when it comes to this piece, there's quite a lot of just repeated exposure to complexity and subtlety and nuance where people are having to make fine distinctions. They're not allowed to oversimplify the world such that it fits their assumptions as they already are, actually to deal with the complexity that real life provides in these sorts of things, which is not always the case with all books. Some books do this and some books do not do this. Community. All are engaged in the pursuit of truth and care for each other in the process. So education, learning, and higher ed doesn't become just, you know, a bothersome, tiresome grind of 40 hours a week of listening someone talk to you, kind of like I'm doing, but for much longer. And the discussions spill out of the classroom because they matter outside the classroom. Teachers. The teachers are there to serve the students, guide their thinking, and respect their process. And so the extent to which faculty are willing to interact. I mean, these people are everywhere. They're not just in one place. There's all kind. You'll wherever it is that you find a collection of faculty members, you'll see the range. You'll see the range. You'll see some who are hard-driven, gotta achieve, get those trophies, get that tenure, et cetera, get that raise. And you have others who, again, in the same institution, who are sort of like, well, you know, I gotta talk to this student. This student sounds like they need to talk. So I'm afraid I'm gonna miss that scholarship meeting because we need to have a conversation about what matters. So you're gonna find a range of people. This is why you should email everyone in the department and ask them sort of like, try to feel them out. What do you like? And then in terms of cost, something humane, something where large debt is discouraged. Debt's a complicated and tricky and touchy subject. Again, much too complicated for me to say much about it now, but the debt that one carries can impact decisions significantly. It can be very difficult and very burdensome. And so when a college's economic model outstrips inflation by 10 to 15% per year, I mean, my question is why? What is it that you're getting for that kind of money? And listen to what they say. You know, don't speculate. Ask an administrator because they should know. They should know. And so what I've seen is that this kind of unique assortment of elements, it does a couple things. It gives students agency and ownership over what it is that they're doing. It makes them feel support and cared for while they're doing a hard thing, which is education, because let's face it, education is a lot of work. They walk away feeling like they have gained a tremendous amount of value and grown a terrific amount in the process of doing this. And now with the tools to think independently, they are not so saddled by economic commitments that they can't actually live out the sorts of commitments that they've been taught to think about. And so this is, to me, I don't know if you all agree or not, but to me, I would say this is an excellent admixture of elements for students. Okay. So that is our six questions that I have posed, but I would love to know if you have any questions for me about college in general or process or, yeah, anything at all. Yes.
I thought you said the average college that was 30,000. Is that recent stat? Like, I was kind of, I
The funny thing about, thanks for your question about the statistic on how much was average college debt. That's the funny thing about statistics is no one seems to be particularly consistent all the time when it comes to statistics. So that's, I can give you the place where I found that number. Let's see, where did I find that number? I made a lot of footnotes. Let's see. This is actually from U.S. News 2021. But you're right. By some standards, this does seem on the lowish side. So, yeah. Thanks for your question. Other questions? Yes, Pam, go ahead. Please. Go ahead.
Why should we even go to college at all? I mean, because you mentioned that maybe not, but why should anyone even consider college in this day and age with the economy and everything related? Why would this even be a thing we should consider?
That's a great question. I think that I would say that our decisions get more and more complex as we age. And to deal with questions and literature content that mirrors that ongoing progression of complexity is very helpful in training one to think about how to make decisions. I would say that. So as I age and I have more perspective and things like that, one of the nice things about higher education is it does create a learning structure where someone is saying, you should read this by Tuesday because now we're going to talk about it. And so it's kind of investing in that kind of support mechanism so that you're actually continuing to do the personal work that one would be wise to continue doing in a structured situation. Like, for example, Gutenberg has a great books curriculum, and some will say, oh, well, you know, just go to the library and read all the great books on my own. I've yet to meet someone who has actually done that because, you know, as things get more complicated and we get more complicated, somehow we have less and less time to do difficult things. So it's a great time, I think, to invest those hours for a temporary amount of time. Yeah. It's a great question. Great question. All right. What would you guys say? Why would you go to college? Okay, yeah, you might feel a particular pull from God to sharpen up a certain set of skills or to learn a new set of skills. Sure, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, some things require medical licenses and oversight, accountability. So yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Yes, I want my heart surgeon to understand the heart. That would be great. For sure.
For me, like over 20 years ago, it just felt like this little sort of like incubator place where I could kind of safely ask questions, be myself, talk to, I mean, get like older people's perspective on things that you only really had your youth past or maybe possibly past your parent, aunt, like maybe 5 to 10 people. Now you've got over 100 peers, maybe 30 you might talk to, and maybe a few handful of faculty that are pretty knowledgeable. So I just like the safe, you know, I didn't have to go to the gas station all the time. I lived on campus the first couple years. I would have never met as many friends or had as many in-depth conversations that I felt really mattered a lot.
Sure.
If I could knock it, I choose to look at where it helped me to go overseas or where it helped me to kind of develop a little more maturity. That's my answer right now.
No, that's great. That's great. I mean, to get all kinds of extra input in an environment where asking for input is encouraged.
And especially if you grew up in a smaller town, say under 30, 20, 15,000 people, then now you're talking to people that might have gone to the University of Stanford, or who knows where they got their education.
Sure, sure. Absolutely, Absolutely. Yeah, there are certain kind of patterns can be helpful and some less so. So getting extra input can be helpful. Sure. Absolutely. Yes, sir.
Nowadays, it seems to me that more and more colleges have focused on ideologies.
Mm-hmm.
And I've read some statistics that were saying that kids, Christian kids that go to college, tend to lose their faith in a vast percentage, like 70-80% Christian kids that go to colleges tend to lose their faith. So that tells me that
No, well, do colleges deal primarily in ideologies or with skills? I mean, I think it's complex. I think it's a mixed bag, to be honest. I think in some cases, yes, that is the case. That, say, for example, in an English department, when we're looking at Shakespeare, for example, you know, the important thing to take away from Shakespeare is what a racist he was, or what a capitalist he was, or whatever ism is the evil ism is the thing that we're supposed to locate. So I think there is a lot of that. I think that tends to dominate more and more. But I do think that there are still zones where skills are actually communicated and offered. And I mean, this is why I would do the research of interacting with instructors. Is your view, instructor, to change the world by making everyone think exactly like you without disagreement or discussion? Because if that's the case, then number one, if we take your class, so I want my kid to know that. That's what they're walking into. And number two, we might do something else. So it's tricky because, you know, an intelligent, articulate-sounding expert at the front of the room can be very compelling against, you know, 20 years of repetitive information from my parents. It's like, oh, you sound really smart. And sometimes they are. The question is, has it all been thought through very well? Well, sometimes yes, and sometimes all that thinking through means that I want to download my ideology to you. So I think you make a good point and raise a really good question, but I don't think that's all of it. But I think it is getting harder and harder to find the real learning opportunities amidst the kind of increasing ideology. Yes, I think there are colleges that do focus on skills. Trade schools focus on skills. A lot of liberal arts schools actually do focus on skills, where you're learning the skill of interpretation and communication and responding and writing, which are all extremely valuable and highly transferable soft skills, as it were. Gutenberg College is one such place that does this, but there are others that also offer valuable skill sets that are not at all ideologically charged. So yes, yeah. I think I'm out of time. Thank you all so much for listening and being here. Again, if you're interested in one of these things, just swing by the Gutenberg booth and someone there will be happy to give you one. So thanks so much for coming.